groove home. Where you at? Come on. Where you at? Come on. Where you at? All my people up in Morgan. Where you at? All my people up in P-Bay. Where you at? All my people's in MCC. Where you at? Where you at? Come on. Where you at? All my people up in Attica. Where you at? All my people up in Sing Sing. Where you at? All my people in San Quentin. Where you at? Come on. Where you at? Come on. Where you at? All my people up in Lompoc. Where you at? All my people up in Orient.
Yes, yes. All my people everywhere then, inside of prison and out. Where you at? I know where we are. We are in Brooklyn, in the beautiful, beautiful studios of WBAI 99.5 FM. Speaking to you is Stephen Humble Mangual, and I just want to say good morning to all of you listening, to all of the brothers and sisters who are still inside. Good morning. I hope you're there listening. It is definitely count time. So this is the time when the radios are and should be on 99.5 FM, so you can get the information and know that, you know, we are here representing you. We are still in, the way Imani always says, we are in advocate and we are definitely in advocacy mode out here on the count. We're going to be talking today. We're going to be spending the hour with Glenn Martin, who is the founder of Just Leadership USA. And I'm definitely looking forward. I've been looking forward to this day for a long time. I actually been talking about this for a while, so I'm just glad, man, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation. He's here in studio with us, which is also a blessing. So today's topic, you know, overall theme and topic is mass incarceration in light of the current climate of reform. But I always want to make sure that we stay focused on, you know, the message we have for the brothers and sisters that are inside, because that's who our main constituency is. That's who our main, you know, support. And that's why we're here. That's why I'm here. You know, I've been home almost 9 years now, but I don't forget. I don't forget about that. I don't forget other people, and I know Glenn doesn't. So, Glenn, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be back, man. I haven't been on in a minute. First thing I'll say is being here reminds me of Eddie Ellis.
Yes.
Who I think about quite often in my work. But being in this space really brings back a lot of memories of Eddie. And if Facebook serves me right, today is Imani's birthday, I believe.
That's right.
So happy birthday to the brother.
Yes, happy birthday, Imani. So what I want to do is, because Glenn has been pretty much across like the nation in different media outlets, and we were just talking about off air how I was watching an interview that he did just recently, where I think the person interviewing you and the media outlet was from Albany, and you were actually in a different studio in New York. So you've been around. You've been on CNN, MSNBC.
MSNBC, Al Jazeera.
Yeah, I kind of been watching and listening. When you were also on NPR couple of months ago together with Piper Kerman.
You're right. I was actually on again this week with Vivian Nixon.
Yes, I got to see that as well. And hopefully we'll be able to have Vivian on next week so she can talk about. I mean, I'm definitely going to get your analysis about what's happening, because you're also co-founder of the Education for
Inside Out Coalition.
Inside Out Coalition, yep. Right. So why don't we start a little bit, because I know there's people who are listening and maybe listening and maybe catching you for the first time. Let's start off with a little bit about you and how you got involved in this whole thing and where that started for you.
Sure. So 2 years ago, I got locked up. I thought I was going to do 2 years, ended up doing 6 joints here in New York State. Got out about 15 years ago. But the moment I had those handcuffs on and started experiencing our criminal justice system, I realized how hypocritical the system was. And I also realized that we lock up some of America's best and brightest. And that's a story that we don't often tell about who is incarcerated in our prison systems here in New York State and around the country. And it's a story I want to tell. It's a story I want to continue to tell. The toughest day for me in prison, as I always say, was the day I was leaving, because I was leaving behind some amazing people. And I think to date, I still have a hard time meeting folks of the caliber of the people who I met in prison. So that's the message I carry around the country. And I think it's important, because the reason we're able to do what we're currently doing is that there's a narrative about people in prison being animals and dehumanizing them. And when you do a good job at dehumanizing people, everything else, all the sort of punishment stuff that we've seen over the last few decades comes really easy. And the average person in the American public just sort of sits back and allows it because it feels to them like we're not doing it to human beings. We're doing it to convicts, prisoners, inmates, animals, wolf packs, you name it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a conversation recently with an attorney with one of those that we call the cop out lawyers that get, you know, court appointed. And the conversation was just really terrible. And she kept using these terms, these dehumanizing terms, to refer to her client who she's supposed to be defending. Yeah, it's definitely disheartening. So mass incarceration, like for those of us, I mean, we're, you know, we're on the count. So obviously those listening are familiar. But what is like the major problem in your analysis and in your expert opinion with mass incarceration and you know, when did that happen? I mean, it wasn't always the case. Like I've heard you and I've read some of your work where you go back and look at the historical perspective. So what happened?
Yeah, you know, I have a firm belief that systems of oppression are durable and they reinvent themselves. And so while mass incarceration hasn't been around forever, and I'll talk about that in a second, I do believe it is the most current iteration of the system of oppression and state-sponsored violence that we've seen in this country, particularly against people of color, people of color. And now, as the system has grown more and more, poor people in general, you know, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that poor white people are just as impacted as other folks these days. And I think until we have a convergence of interests on this issue, we're not going to see true reform. So I continue to remind people that it's not just black folks locked up. I mean, we're locked up disproportionately. But mass incarceration, I mean, think about it. You had the civil rights era and you had a bunch of wins, if you will. I mean, it's the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act.
That's right.
And you could almost argue it's the 50th anniversary of mass incarceration. And I think that there's no mistake in that correlation. I think not only did we start locking people up for things that weren't even considered criminal just a few years earlier, but we've locked people up for longer periods of time. There's no evidence suggesting that the longer sentences has done anything to make us safer as a state, as a country, as a city. However, we've engaged in that experiment, and then we've attached lifetime consequences to it, punishment that never goes away based on having a criminal record. And luckily now, as a country, we're having a renewed conversation about what we can do differently. But with 100 million Americans with an arrest and or conviction record on file, we've essentially gone so far down this road that we've created an entire underclass of citizenship in this country. And of course, now, again, it's gone beyond, I would argue, the people who were originally targeted for this sort of mass criminalization, mostly men of color. And the system is on autopilot. You know, I mean, the system right now has a mind of its own. It's become an economic engine for communities all across this country. I have a brother who ended up being a federal correction officer, and now he's a U.S. Marshal. And I love my brother to death, but, you know, when I talked to him about these issues, he'd be the first to say, look, I didn't put these people here as long as I'm not abusing them. And to me, that just lacks a systemic analysis of why this system exists and the role that he plays in it. But I also recognize that, you know, systems change people before people change systems. And so there's such an insidious culture in our criminal justice system that anyone who becomes part of it, even if they don't come in willfully, meaning to perpetuate this system of oppression, they quickly become part of the system. So that's a bit of my analysis. I mean, we would have to have a very long show for me to give you my full analysis. But that's my basic analysis.
But now this whole there's this whole movement now that has been taking place, and it's bipartisan. I mean, it's huge now. You have people like the Koch brothers, who I'm still trying to wrap that around my head. How the Koch brothers, you know, are taking, you know, positions where they're speaking out against mass incarceration, and it's like, okay, now they're also playing a role. So what is your analysis, and how do you feel about that? Not just the Koch brothers, but we also have the Clintons. Right. So now President Clinton, who under his, you know, presidentship, the incarceration rate, you know, definitely skyrocketed. Right.
Doubled easily.
Yeah. So and of course, obviously, more currently, President Obama. But talk a little bit about that. The Clintons, the Koch brothers.
So, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm glad that people who have access to power and privilege are finally speaking up. My question is whether or not the changes that we're going to see over the next few years will match the rhetoric, first of all. Mm-hmm. And will the reforms match the scope of the problem? You know, I run an organization that has an ambitious goal of cutting the number of people in prison in the United States in half by 2030. Why? Do I think that's going to solve the problem? No, not necessarily, but I do believe that we are in a field that is mired in incrementalism. I think that we have spent too long only focusing on incremental reforms and not having a big picture shared vision for what significant reform might look like. And the reason I launched this organization, which I hope we get a chance to talk more about, mm-hmm. is I think what's lacking from that national bipartisan conversation about reform is the people who are most impacted by these issues and the communities that are most impacted. And when I think of the folks who have the most stake in the outcome of reform, I ask myself, why are these folks not at the table? I conceptualized this organization not just based on everything I've learned from people like Eddie Ellis and Devine Pryor and other folks who've been around a lot longer than I mm-hmm. doing this work, but based on, you know, Martin Luther King's work, right, and other great leaders in this country who realize that, you know, if you have a base of people that are impacted by an issue, how can they be not just left out of the conversation, but left out of leadership mm-hmm. Behind the movement? And, you know, I'm always cautious, actually, about even calling this a movement, because if you look historically, I cannot identify any other movement where the people who are most impacted by an oppressive system aren't able to rise up, redefine the problem, and lead us to a solution.
Hmm. So talk a little bit about your experience. I mean, you went to the White House. Right. And so I remember reading and seeing some of your posts, and you actually wrote a letter that you sent to President Obama afterwards, because your experience, you know, was a telltale sign of, you know, this oppressive system that we're talking about. I mean, here you are. You've been out all of these years. You have this huge organization. You get invited by the president to the White House to talk about, you know, reform, which he has been touting, which, you know, a lot of people say that It's a lot of people don't agree with it. He has some strong critics about his you know, President Obama's so-called reform and his approach. But tell us a little about that experience at the White House.
Sure. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the good stuff coming out of the administration. Yeah. But yeah, let me tell you about that experience. And that experience is indicative of what really concerns me here when you are pushing for reform and it's not a value-driven conversation, right? If it's just about saving money, it's not going to get us to the finish line. And if it's not about redefining the underlying values of our criminal justice system, if it's about another way to punish people, I find that extremely problematic. So I get invited to the White House for a discussion about mass incarceration and policing and gun violence. And I get there with 50 of my colleagues from around the country. We're talking about prosecutors and law enforcement and advocates and all types. It was meant to be a multidisciplinary conversation. Mm-hmm. And when we get to the White House, I immediately notice that I'm handed a different color ID than everyone else. And, you know, if you have a criminal record, you're always looking out for this stuff, mm-hmm. right? Whether you're renting an apartment or trying to get a loan or whatever, like that scarlet letter stays with you forever. Mm-hmm. And so I knew it was coming. So I go through 3-4 levels of security like everyone else. And obviously the White House has significant levels of security for you to get through. And I get to the finish line like everyone else. And there's a law enforcement officer there, Secret Service, that stops me and says, "You need an escort." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you need an escort to go into the White House." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I don't know, but your ID says escort." Of course, I knew why. I just wanted to hear him articulate it. What was really hilarious, well, first of all, it was very embarrassing. It actually brought me back to my days of being incarcerated, that sort of humiliating journey they put you through as you go through orientation and corrections, the whole stripping you of your identity and so on. And I thought about the 15 years, arguably 20 years of work I've done on this issue, and how walking into the White House for a discussion, I was suddenly put right back where I was 20 years ago. And, you know, I think the funniest part about the whole thing, and I don't think I've shared this with any other media outlet, but I'll say it here. Why not? Is eventually this young white intern comes out to get me. She's 23, 24 years old. And she says, "Are you?" And before she could finish her sentence, I was like, "Yes." And I'm waiting. I got to get to this meeting. I'm already 20 minutes late. Uh-huh. And so she grabs me. The Secret Service guy is like, "Okay, thanks, bye." And we get about 100 feet away. And she said, "Are you Mr. Simmons?" I said, no, I'm Mr. Martin. She was like, oh, my God, I think I grabbed the wrong person. So that just added insult to injury, right? Here's this black man 20 years later trying to get into the White House after being invited. And this young white intern just comes strolling out and grabs whoever she wants to grab and pulls him right into the White House. So I'm not sure it was a security issue, ultimately.
Wow. But talk about some of the good things coming out.
Sure, you know, yeah. So a week and a half ago, Vivian Nixon, who helped, who's the co-founder of the Education from the Inside Out Coalition, and the Center for Community Alternatives is the third partner. But Vivian and I and Dallas Pell, the daughter of Senator Claiborne Pell, were the three civilians invited to an announcement being made by the administration at Maryland Correctional Institution Jessup, which is a prison out in Maryland. And it was about something Vivian and I and others have been working on for a really long time, which is the reinstatement of Pell Grant eligibility for people in prison. I benefited from earning a two-year liberal arts degree at the consortium at the Niagara Frontier. And I've been working on this Pell Grant issue since I came home. And so this is not a congressional win. We didn't get Congress to do it. But we did work with the administration and help them understand that within the existing regulations, there's a chance for them to do a pilot project where they give Pell Grant eligibility back to people in prison. Mm-hmm. As long as it's a research project. And okay. And so they put out a request for proposals, and we submitted a proposal, the coalition, and they chose it. And so using the governor's, the president's executive power, suddenly now there's a pilot project that colleges across the country can apply for to propose college programs in prison around the country. And so we don't know what the scope is going to be yet. I mean, it's only a few $1,000s. Secretary Duncan was there, the Secretary of Education. Loretta Lynch was there, the Attorney General of the United States. And as Secretary Duncan said, it's budget dust. You know, people were asking him, what about all this money you're going to be spending? He was like, you got to be kidding. It's budget dust. It's a few million dollars. But
wasn't that always the case, though, when we're talking about TAP and Pell for people in
that's
prisons?
A good point, man. It was 0.1% of the overall Pell Grant budget. So when the Pell Grant budget was $3.5 billion, it was only $35 million. Mm-hmm. And now the Pell Grant budget is $35 billion. But the point is that, you know, if you reinstate it, look, you know, I have a hard time even articulating this because I have a hard time believing I got to prove to people that education makes a difference. But I'll say this for my critics, which is I believe that government has a responsibility to do what works, to do more of what works and less of what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have 50 years showing that incarceration without rehabilitation doesn't work, right? Like 60% failure rate. What other industry would operate with that failure rate but prisons? But we also know that access to education is a game changer. And it's not just a game changer to help people get a job. I do think it's important for people to become more competitive in the labor market. But let's be frank. I mean, I came home and I visited 50 employers and I still couldn't find a job in the first 30 days. But what education did for me was to help me better understand sort of who I am, how I fit into society, why I probably couldn't get a job at that point. It gave me self-esteem, self-efficacy. It gave me the ability to access resources. It sort of recalibrated my moral compass. It helped me to stop othering people, the kind of stuff that makes it easy to commit crime. And it's funny because people who talk about they don't want to pay for it, the truth is you're already paying. You're already paying. I mean, if you look in New York City, Rikers Island, you're paying $167,000 per bed per year. You know, I mean, I wish people would be that critical about the amount of money they're spending on an incarceration system that doesn't work as they do on a $6,000 a year Pell Grant that can turn things around.
So now that you mentioned Rikers Island, that's a good segue. There's been a lot.
You're going to get me fired up in here.
Yeah. But let's talk about Rikers Island because, I mean, there's been a lot happening. I mean, there's been reports that have been coming out around solitary confinement. There's been some good news, right, where some laws and bills have been passed and some laws created to protect juveniles regarding solitary confinement. There's been a lot of spotlight taking place regarding the abuses that have been taking place in Rikers Island. So, you know, what do you think? What's taken place and what needs to take place regarding...
I mean, first of all, hats off to like the Jails Action Coalition and other folks who've been pushing for these reforms really hard for many years. And hats off to the folks from Black Lives Matter. Yes. I think we got to realize that power can seize nothing without a demand. And we all know Eddie would have said that.
That's right.
And I think the folks who are out there in the street putting their lives at risk is a big part of what we're seeing, the reforms that we're seeing currently. So I want to give credit where it's due, first of all. And then I want to give a little bit of credit to the administration, a little bit, just a little bit, because they have made some changes. And the reason it resonates with me is because I went to Rikers when I was 16. I went to Rikers when I was 17. I went to Rikers when I was 19. And then I ultimately went to Rikers when I was 23. Mm-hmm. The only scars I have on my body comes from Rikers Island. I got a stab wound in my neck. I got two in my back. Mm. I mean, they don't call it gladiator school for nothing.
Yeah, but then when I saw the DOJ,
you know, it's funny because I was at the mayor's inauguration. And so this is day one, right? You just became the mayor. About an hour later, after standing in a freezing cold to take a picture with the mayor, I get to the mayor and I was like, you know, Mr. Mayor, with all due respect, I can take a picture with you any day. I'm here to tell you you should close Rikers.
Wow.
And, you know, he looked at me like I was out of my mind. He was like, why do you say that? And I said, look, I served time on Rikers and I'm telling you, it is a cesspool of abuse. Like, you know, the problem with Rikers is Rikers, like the plant, the facility. Like, you have to decentralize our jail system in New York, like move people back into the boroughs, reduce the amount of beds, right? We have 15,000 beds. At one point, there were 23,000 people there when I was there. Granted, we're down to 9,600, but a city of this size can get by with 5,000 beds, 4,500 beds, more rehabilitation. And, you know, I know you have the union pushing back. I'm not naive about that. Norman Seabrook out there trying to characterize all of our children as animals. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I actually don't care if they lose correction jobs or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you want to have 2-3 correction officers in the dorm versus one, I don't care about that. I care about our children and their lives and them surviving. And that's what the discussion is really about. It's about life or death.
Yeah.
Right. And people don't get that. People think that this discussion is about saving money. They think this discussion is about, you know, liberalism and so on. This is about life or death for a lot of our young folks, because Rikers is a scary place. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the DOJ report, and you look at the details of it, anyone who's ever spent time on Rikers says to themselves, wait a minute, this has been going on for decades. This is not brand new. I mean, Khalif, you know, gave his life for New Yorkers to pay attention to this issue. And I'm sorry that he lost his life, but I am glad that it helped humanize it for some people who weren't paying attention at all. And I think that the least we can do as advocates, as New Yorkers, is to honor his sacrifice and ultimately close the plant. I don't think it's about reforming Rikers. I don't think there's any such thing.
And for those who are probably maybe not familiar, because you just mentioned his first name, Khalif Browder.
Khalif Browder, who was a young man who unfortunately served 3 years on Rikers as a detainee. You know, I said there's 9,600 people there. 82% of them are actually detainees.
Because they can't pay bail.
In a country where you're innocent till proven guilty, you know, we talk about them as if they're already guilty. Even if they were, I don't want to live in a country where my taxpaying dollars is used to create a facility just off the richest city probably in the world, definitely the most progressive in the world, right next to LaGuardia Airport, where people fly in and out every day, and yet we're running a prison that's not much different than where we lock up alleged terrorists.
Yeah.
And as New Yorkers, I think we don't own that. And I think the mayor needs to own it. And I think every New Yorker needs to own it, because it belongs to us.
Yeah,
you know, systems like that exist because we allow it to exist, because we believe in it. And we can wake up tomorrow and decide we don't believe in this kind of punishment for people, or that we want to find proportionality, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying punishment is not acceptable for people who break the law. What I am saying is that punishment alone is how we've gotten where we are now. And part of it is that we have this fear-driven way of policymaking in the United States, and 9/11 made it that much worse. Oh, yeah. And it was many years ago, I think it was actually Benjamin Franklin, who said, if you sacrifice liberty in the name of security, you ultimately lose both.
I think that's
where we've ended up as a city, as a state, and as a country.
So Khalif spent 3 years, about two-thirds of that, in solitary confinement. Oh, there's been study after study, report after report, where adolescents, I mean anybody, but specifically adolescents, because of the brain development, right, they spend any more than 15 days in prison, they're going to develop mental illness. And what's happening, a lot of them are not being diagnosed, a lot of them are not being treated. So I believe this is what happened to Khalif. Then he comes home and he's trying to deal with this mental illness that he wound up developing in Rikers Island. He's trying to work with society. He went back to school. He actually went to Bronx Community College, which where I got my associate's degree from, and so definitely close to home. And I mean, wind up committing suicide. It's just I'm talking about it's such a sad, you know, reality of our children who are in Rikers Island right now, who
trauma.
Yeah, how that's, facing this trauma.
That's the word that comes to mind for me, trauma. You know, you can't experience Rikers without being traumatized. I don't care how strong you are. I mean, the truth is, to survive there, you actually do sort of need to become a survivor really quickly. But human beings actually have the ability to adapt to survive in situations. And unfortunately, the thing about Rikers is that it's so dangerous that either you become prey or you become the person who's preying on others as a way to survive. And who knows what he experienced in there, but I know that the videos that we saw of police officers beating him up to me were extremely clear, but also, again, nothing new to me. I mean, I spent a year on Rikers before I went up north and did the other five, and none of this surprises me. I mean, maybe it surprises the average New Yorker who hasn't been paying attention, but anyone who has spent any amount of time on Rikers realizes that there's nothing new about it. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, I mean, I talked about 9,600 people being there, 82% of them being detainees. Well, 50% of those detainees, a few thousand people, have bail of less than $2,000. But if you're poor, $2,000 may as well be $2 million. Yeah. Except if you look at these cases, you realize that these are like really petty offenses. And there's places around the country, there's definitely places in other countries where the kind of things we lock people up for in this city, people would get a summons for.
Yeah.
And so we just really have to rethink criminal justice and get off of autopilot, if you will. And I don't think it'll diminish safety. In fact, New York City has proved to the world, I believe, that you can reduce the amount of people locked up and simultaneously reduce crime. I mean, we are enjoying a reduction in severe crime rates in New York that mirror 1961 with half the amount of people sitting on Rikers, maybe even less than when I went there 20 years ago.
Wow. So we still have a few minutes before the break. Let's talk a little bit about Ban the Box, right? So during President Obama's speech at the NAACP National Convention, he laid out this plan, right, to reform our supposed, and these are his words, right, broken criminal justice system, including calling upon employers to ban the box on job applications. So this is happening at the federal level. But we also have here in New York, where recently the mayor and, you know, really the mayor signed into law, but other people who played a role in the Fair Chance Act. So, and you already mentioned previously some of the collateral consequences of incarceration, and which you yourself experienced regarding looking for work and going to all of these places. So talk a little bit about your thoughts regarding this whole Ban the Box and the Fair Chance Act.
Well, first of all, shout out to Vocal as one of the groups that helped drive this and other groups here in New York City. But let's first remind the audience that Ban the Box was started by people who have actually served time in prison, namely one of my board members, Dorsey Nunn, and other formerly incarcerated people out on the West Coast who had enough, who said, you know, you can't keep denying us access to the labor market, and that criminal record-based discrimination is a surrogate for race-based discrimination. Whether it's intentional or not, because we've locked up so many people of color in this country. And so having the president utter those words at a speech at the NAACP in and of itself was a huge win. I believe that people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but usually furthest from power and resources. And when I see the most powerful man arguably in this world at this point saying something in an important speech that comes, that is the brainchild of someone who's actually served time in prison, I think that is a win in and of itself for the movement, if you will. So, I mean, I've done a lot of work on employment. Folks might remember I used to run the National Hire Network at the Legal Action Center, and Hire stands for helping individuals reenter through employment. And so I think Ban the Box is one of those tools that we can use to level the playing field. First of all, the federal government is the largest employer in the United States. And so it's great to have the president telling private employers that they should ban the box and they should do the right thing. But my question would be, what are you going to do? You know, how are you going to lead? And so I was just in front of the White House recently on the lawn with formerly incarcerated people from all over this country, advocating for the president to adopt an executive order to ban the box on the federal level. And of course, that'll create a lot of opportunities for people, because what it does is that it delays the criminal record check until further on in the process. So if you think of the Americans with Disability Act, mm-hmm. For instance, yeah. You get offered a job and then the disability is taken into account so that you can actually see whether the employer is discriminating based on the disability. And in this case, based on the criminal record.
Okay. Thank you. No, excuse me. I didn't want to cut you off, but it is 11:30, or is it 11:31? You got 11:31 over there, so it is definitely time for our station break. So it is 11:31, and you are listening to On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. Still Eddie Ellis's show. This is Stephen Humble Mangual here sitting in for Eddie. Big shout out to Rob Sims and Imani and Khalil, the rest of the crew. But we're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to recap with Glenn and Khalil.
Yeah, check it. Young so Felice, only four when she learned how to bite. Now, team riding in the mic. I tell her that ain't nice. Why you right? She said, in my OB. Know me, it's so much pain in my life. Same Felice, she the one that hit the game. She Jermaine, cause Jermaine had a name. Now, when she on the potty, she feel like pain. Then she knows her to change better. She see all kinds of things. Just that for her to take HIV that yeah, now and when she wait in the so stressed.
So much pain in my life.
Need the bum on the when I ask him why quarter was it what the government that he thirsty out the water, but he said stronger. He said it's
in my life.
Damn, he was shunning the sun is gonna burn stomach. First I said, ah, but then after him it was clear life was his life and no woman.
So yeah. Much
well, I'm the keeper, no, I'm Felicia, we're killing them, fatherless daughter, fatherless father, an infomaniac, got thoughts in the bottle, with the help of them, Bible, they both, they find religion, I do, I can give a dollar, but what I do, now they got, all survive,
so much pain in my life.
In My Life, Pain in My Life by Saigon, one of my favorite. And I don't know if the people are aware, but Saigon is also a student of Eddie Ellis, a student of the non-traditional approach to criminal social justice. He's a part of the Resurrection Study Group, as was his mentor and friend, who recently passed away, Sharif. So rest in peace, and you know, our thoughts to his family still, who was also mentored by Eddie Ellis. So we have Khalil on the phone, and I want to apologize, Khalil, I didn't get you on a little earlier, but I wanted to, you know, spend some time with Glenn for the first half and then have you on, and I hope that's okay, but I'm glad that you're on. Khalil, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you for having me, and no worries. I probably better utilize the time listening to Glenn anyway.
you're old hair for On the Count. You're old hair. We've heard your voice before. No, but I'm glad. I'm glad that you're on, and I really appreciate it. But I definitely wanted to get your input, your analysis, and experience regarding, you know, criminal justice reform, and you know, your work with Just Leadership USA, as well as your work at the Legal Action Center. So why don't we begin by some of your expertise? So you, those of us who are on the count, we know the experience that you went through, you know, regarding the immigration situation and you being reincarcererated through immigration and that whole thing, and then coming home, which was a blessing. But then even after that, that was not the end for you. You've continued to be an advocate and a voice regarding the connections between, you know, criminal justice, immigration, and also, you know, the interactions within regarding systemic racism and classism and that kind of stuff. So why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, that work post, you know, release from immigration and that work that you've been doing?
Sure. So on May 8th, 2014, a little bit over a year ago, my wife and I got a knock on the door. It was around 7 o'clock in the morning. And it was what appeared to be police officers. And, you know, as someone who has had experience with the criminal justice system and who has lived a regular life after incarceration, you know, having a police officer at the door, while it does present some form of anxiety, you know, I very much felt like I didn't have anything to hide. So when they asked to come in, they had a few questions that they were conducting an investigation. My wife and I, sure, right? I mean, we don't have anything to hide. So we let them in. And it was in our living room, with our two daughters sleeping in their bedrooms, that they told us the real reason that they were there, that they were really there for me, that they were there to arrest me and bring me to immigration detention because of my conviction at that point, which was well over a year ago. Now, I was 1 week away from completing a graduate degree. I was on the precipice of entering a new chapter of my life, not only with reentry post-incarceration, but also educationally, professionally, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this was very much a blow for me as a person, as someone who struggled and fought and dug in and really worked really hard to rebuild a legacy for myself. And, you know, to have someone just drag you back into a system that is hell-bent on punishment, as Glenn had mentioned, was just devastating for me, for my family, and ultimately for the community that I served, that I worked with. So, you know, we pushed really hard, and on October 10th, 2014, a little bit over 5 months after my detention began, I was ultimately released by the government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very much in the same manner that I questioned what were my next steps when I was released from incarceration from the New York State Department of Corrections, I found myself very much in the same position, and I asked myself again, you know, what will you do with this opportunity? Because the reality is that Khalil is no one exceptional. And while there are people that will tell that narrative, I always believe that it is important to highlight that there are many other Khalils, that there are people in the prison system, there are people in immigration detention that have the same exact story as I do. And the only difference is that they didn't have access to the resources that I had access to. And so how do we make my story the rule and not the exception? So that's the space that I found myself in. I had founded a company called Kinetic Solutions a little bit over 3 years prior. So when I came home, that's kind of like the work that I picked up. And obviously I was still connected to the issues and learning a lot more about the intersection of immigration and criminal justice. And then ultimately I got involved in Just Leadership.
Yes.
Now, I knew Glenn Martin when he was at Fortune Society. I was very fortunate to work with him on a project a little bit over 4 months after my release, where we gave out 700 book bags in West Harlem with money that was strictly from people who were incarcerated at Greenhaven Correctional Facility. So these men raised money, donated thousands of dollars to give out book bags in a community that has been not only heavily impacted by mass incarceration, but also other socioeconomic issues that lent to mass incarceration. And when Glenn told me that he was starting an organization that was going to focus on empowering the people who are closest to the problem to put them in the position to be closest to the solution, I said, you know, where can I sign up?
Yeah.
And I came out of immigration detention in October, and they started taking applications very shortly thereafter. I was very fortunate enough to survive the very rigorous application process, and I was chosen as one of the first 20 members in the inaugural cohort of what is called the Leading with Conviction. And, you know, that very much began a different chapter of my life, because for the first time as a professional, as someone who had survived incarceration, I was put into a position where someone acknowledged the fact that I was a leader.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge misconception about what this leadership training that Just Leadership is doing is about. Because when most people hear leadership training, the connotation is that you don't actually know how to be a leader. So yeah. Therefore, you're coming here to learn how to be a leader or be an effective leader or to build on lacking leadership skills.
So why don't we, I don't mean to cut you off, but let me, because I want you to continue on that. But I want Glenn to come in here a little bit and talk about Just Leadership and the creation of Just Leadership and why this specific approach, which is the approach that part of the approach that you're talking about in leadership. So why this approach to criminal justice reform? You came from the Legal Action Center, spent time there, then you went and spent some time with the Fortune Society, actually as a vice president of the Fortune Society. And then after that, like, something went off in your head and you're like, okay, no, it's time for Just Leadership. I think maybe it was because of, I remember reading where there was an experience with you and your son, Josh, and
yeah,
you were like, the kind of
that.
World that you want him to have.
Right.
But talk a little bit about that specific, unique perspective, analysis, and approach to criminal justice reform that comes from Just Leadership.
All right, cool. First thing I got to say, though, is Khalil not the most humble cat you've ever met? Like, an amazing leader, and at the same time,
yeah,
just so humble, and I admire him for that. And so I appreciate all his kind words, but the truth is I learned just as much from the leaders in the training as they learned from us. So about 2.5 years ago, I started really thinking heavily about where we were as a country on this issue. And we seemed to be having a series of moments, but it didn't feel to me like we were in a movement. But it did feel like the things were lining up to get us there. And yet, at the same time, it felt that something was really missing. And I took a week off work, which is rare for me. I think it's probably the first week I took off in the 6 years I worked at the Fortune Society. And I hired a friend of mine who's a lawyer to sit with me and to really help me flesh out some of these ideas about what was missing in the field. And we came out with a concept paper, but I always talk about what that process was like, because I think that that's germane to where we landed in terms of our theory of change. One part is, yeah, I was sitting there with my son, Joshua, and Joshua was 3 at the time. And, you know, we talk about cutting the number of people under correctional supervision in half by 2030. And, you know, that's when Joshua is going to be 18.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of symbolism in that for a black man growing up in America and trying to make it to 18 without being locked up. And so that was part of why I thought we needed a very ambitious goal. But for me, one that was also very personal, right? So how do you save the world and save a child at the same time? And I think everyone should have their sort of global reason for wanting to see mass incarceration end, but it should also have their personal reason, because both of those things get me up in the morning and allow me to work the really long hours it takes to do what it is that we do at Just Leadership USA. And it was also the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So it was August 2013. And I just kept asking myself, like, you know, what would King be thinking right now? What would he be thinking about the sort of incremental approach that we're taking to a problem is a juggernaut of a problem, if you will. And I think he would argue that we're never going to get to the finish line if we only chip away. I mean, I get that, you know, a million cuts got us here, and it's going to take a million cuts to Band-Aids to get us out of here. But at the same time, if you don't have a bold goal that people can sort of get behind, then we're never going to get to a tipping point. And what I've learned since then about bold goals is, first of all, that when you say something bold out loud, people tend to look at you like you have lost your mind, right? So that's where it started. People were like, well, first of all, you walked away from this amazing job that most people who serve time would be happy just to be in that position. And it was, you know, I loved working at the Fortune Society. It was a great place to work. I had a lot of influence there, a lot of access, a lot of resources. So it was a difficult decision. But in the end, The idea was this. How do I make it so that Glenn Martin is no longer the exception, right? Because that's what people kept doing. The same thing that they do to Khalil from time to time is people try to exceptionalize me. And I realized I was just exposed to a lot of exceptional opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so the question was, how do I do that for other people, right? So it's not how do you find people and turn them into leaders. That's pretty naive. It's how do you find existing leaders and invest in them the way people invested in me or the way I was able to access resources to invest in myself. I think it was a combination of those two things. Because I think the field, unfortunately, hasn't been very deliberate about building a second bench of leadership. And I think that that is a failure of the field. I think it's one that the field recognizes, but it's a failure of the field. And so a year-long leadership training, how did we develop it? We developed it from scratch. Mm-hmm. We started out, you know, tabula rasa, like assuming we knew nothing about the people we hoped to serve. And what did we do? We listened. We found 60 formerly incarcerated leaders from around the country. We went to Columbia University and asked them, would they help us do some research? And we interviewed those people a couple hours long. And then we coded the interviews and we learned some lessons about what people like me were exposed to going all the way back to their childhood that helped them to elevate as leaders post-incarceration. Mm. And we use that to develop this year-long curriculum. So we bring people to New York a few times a year. We pay for everything. The investment that the leaders make is their time, if you will. We pay for the travel. We pay for the hotels. We pay for transportation. We pay for food, lodging, and so on, because we want people to pay attention to the curriculum, to the opportunity to invest in themselves. And most importantly, you know, I say people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but never forget the second part, which is they're also furthest from power and resources.
Yeah.
And so part of our training is not just building their capacity to be stronger leaders, but exposing them to resources and building their network. And I think one good example, and I hope Khalil will agree with me, was we had a panel discussion with the heads of four major foundations from around the country, including the head of the Ford Foundation. I mean, it took me a decade to get through the doors of the Ford Foundation. And I'm glad that they support us now.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you think of the fact that people like Khalil have, you know, he doesn't just bring his story to the table. Yeah. He brings his analysis to the table. He brings his experiential knowledge to the table. And yet, if he can't access resources, it's hard to take that from theory to fruition. And so we want to change that. And so that's a big part of what we do. And then finally, our year-long training is very competitive. So we have these emerging leaders trainings that we do around the country. We just did the first one in New York. It's a day long. 51 people attended, formerly incarcerated from four different states. And it's a chance for other formerly incarcerated people that may not have reached the level of folks like Khalil to have some level of exposure to our theory of change and what it is that we do to help strengthen leaders. And we're also a membership organization. We have over 11,000 members in 42 different states around the country. And the membership is only $12 a year, very deliberately, because we want people in prison, we want formerly incarcerated people to be able to afford to be members. It's only $1 a month. But for other people who have the ability to be a member for $12 a year and also give another $10 for a person in prison to be a member, we try to inspire them to do that also.
So, Khalil, why don't you jump in here now? Your experience, your expertise, and now your work with Just Leadership, how has that been? Talk about the getting involved in this approach and having that play out in your work.
Yes, I mean, as Glenn has mentioned, the main benefit I would say is one, the level of empowerment that the leadership training gives you to walk into these rooms understanding that in many ways you are the expert. That your experiential, that the fact that you live the experience gives you that right to say that you're an expert. And then access to the platforms and the resources. I mean, recently I was on a panel in Washington, D.C. with Glenn and Xavier McElroy Bay, all, you know, formerly incarcerated men who were invited to this panel to talk about our experiences. And, you know, while some may say, well, you know, that's not what really changes hearts and minds, it doesn't really move policy, the reality is that people are becoming more and more aware that if you're going to talk about solutions to a massive problem like mass incarceration, you need to have those directly impacted by the issue, not only involved in the conversation, but also dictating what will be talked about, dictating what the agenda will be, and so on and so forth. So for me, those are the two major things. The fact that I am empowered by not only the Just Leadership team, particularly Glenn, but also from the other cohort members. I mean, I have 19 other people doing similar work, all formerly incarcerated, all have experience with the criminal justice system across the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's a network that has been given to me by my involvement in Just Leadership. Mm. And as Glenn mentioned, right, like he's streamlining the process because essentially what we need are all hands on deck. Right?
Yeah.
Like he mentioned a million cuts and like it's going to take a million Band-Aids and one person or a group of people can't initiate those million Band-Aids. We need all hands on deck. And that's what the leadership training is really about, is to expose you to other people doing the work. And then in turn, that becomes a wider network because you have access to their network. Some of the work that I've been doing recently within the last 4 months has been exclusively with Just Leadership cohort members. Yesterday, I was at a presentation with one of the cohort members, Donna Hilton. And, you know, and we were invited there through Just Leadership because of our experience,
yeah,
right? Because of our lived experience. So those are the two major things that I would say that I got out of Just Leadership. And then, of course, and then I'm going to try to make Glenn blush here, you know, having a stronger relationship with someone that I totally admire and
yeah.
respect and, you know, who in many ways inspires me.
That's a blessing. That's definitely a blessing.
Thanks, Khalil. I wanted to build out on something Khalil said was about hearts and minds. And so people minimize that, right? Like we think that the way to get out of this mess that we're in is strictly through legislative change or administrative policy change.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I believe and you know what my experience is, that ultimately people make decisions with their gut, right? People, no matter how much you tell them about the cost, no matter how much you tell them about recidivism, all those things are important, and you tend to get a visceral reaction from people. When I say 100 million Americans have an arrest or criminal record on file, like people sit back and say, wow. And I would argue that if I asked them the question a week later, what did I say, they'll probably get the number wrong. Because in the end, whatever narrative people have going on in their heads, and if that narrative is that Black and Latino men are scary and we should keep them away from us, then you can tell them we're spending $167,000 per bed per year on Rikers, and they'll just continue to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And so I think the way you undo that is to undo the stigma that they have in their minds about who it is that we lock up in this country and who can listen to Khalil talk and not sit back and say, wait a minute, that's not fair. That's not right. Like, mm-hmm. is that who yeah. we lock up? Is that what we turn people into? And hear his story of turning his own life around, if you will, or of redemption, or of just the power and gifts that he brings to the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
not just about keeping people out of prison, getting them a roof over their heads, getting them a job. Like, those things are important. I get it. Maslow's hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
But people who we lock up in this country can also add value to this country.
Yeah.
And we have to get to that level of conversation if we're going to turn this into a movement. And I want to believe we're in a movement. I know that movements are difficult to define when you're in the middle of them. So I keep waking up hopeful that we are. But I think that if we think that it's going to happen passively without us speaking up and speaking out loud and telling the truth and saying things that make people uncomfortable and reminding people with privilege that they have to not just identify their privilege and step away from it,
mm-hmm.
but identify it and wield it.
Yeah.
You know, when I left Fortune, people say, well, how do you walk away from a job where you were doing so well and you had so much access to power? You know, I mean, there were meetings with the mayor where there's only me and three other people and the mayor sitting there in mm-hmm. City Hall. And that's a pretty powerful position to be in. But how can I go around telling other people to wield their privilege when I wasn't thinking about what I would do with my own? And
mm-hmm.
and so leaving, you know, Joanne Page, who runs Fortune, says sometimes you have to leap and build your wings on the way down. And it was a bit of doing that in building Just Leadership. But I was
yeah.
hugely confident that I'd be able to build those wings before mm-hmm. I crashed and burned because I put a lot of thought into this theory of change. And here it is almost a year later since we launched on November 12th of last year. And if you listen to Khalil's story, I can sit back and feel comfortable that
yeah.
this was the right thing to do. I think we're still learning lessons, but, you know, for Khalil's story alone, this would have been worth all the investment that I and others made to get this organization off the ground.
And in the little bit of time that we have left, and I knew we were never going to have enough time, definitely. An hour is not enough to spend with Glenn, so we're going to have to definitely schedule a part two. But a message to the men and women who are locked up right now. Because that's who's important to us. That's why we do what we do. Because, you know, we were there. and we're still, you know, we're tridimensional beings. We live past, present, and future. So we're connected to them. And so what's the message for them regarding this movement? Because they also need to be involved in this movement.
Yeah. So we have a lot of people who are in prison who are part of our membership very deliberately, because I agree, when you lock up 2.3 million people, you don't ignore them as part of your base for reform. In fact, they have a huge amount of stake in the outcome. Mm-hmm. So I'll say that first of all. The second thing I'll say is around responsibility. You know, if you're sitting in prison and you're thinking about what's next, particularly if you're short to come home, you know, a big part of your behavior and what you do when you exit prison is going to help us either make the case for reform or help our opponents make the case for continuing down the road that we've been going now. So you have some individual responsibility mm-hmm. to do the right thing or surround yourself with people who are going to keep you strong. And then lastly, don't ever doubt that you can be blank, and you fill in the blank, whatever that blank needs to be. Whatever you want to be in this world. When I worked at the Legal Action Center as a paralegal in particular, which arguably was the most important 2 years of my career because I was listening to people who are formerly incarcerated every single day. And what I learned is that when people picked up the phone and called me and they wanted to be something, even if there was a statutory barrier, even if there was something in the law that said they couldn't do it, I would never tell people they couldn't do it. Because look at my story. I mean, I exited prison 15 years ago, $100,000 in debt, criminal record, barred by 50 employers. And then 7 years later, I was helping to run this organization that was serving 4,000 people per year. And I hope that serves as an example to people who are now sitting behind bars wondering whether they can achieve what they want to achieve. And then the last thing I'll say is, you know, have a bold and audacious plan, but then have a few backup plans.
Yeah.
You know, people come out and they want to change the world overnight. Don't forget, I didn't get here overnight. Mm. You know, I remember living in the Bronx because I couldn't afford to live in Brooklyn where I grew up, and walking miles just to get to work because I couldn't afford money to get on the train while I'm watching everyone having all the nice things that I hoped to have before I went to prison, and just being humble about it. So, you know, people see me now and they think I walked out of prison and walked right into this role. Mm-hmm. I struggled.
Yeah.
And so be prepared for that. You know, have a vision and see yourself someplace better, but be prepared to struggle, because this is a very vindictive world, particularly for people with criminal records.
Khalil. Literally 30 seconds, man. Your message.
Yeah, in 30 seconds, I would just re-emphasize the importance of individual responsibility, as Glenn said. I mean, the same way that people are going to hold myself and you and Glenn accountable mm-hmm. for what we do and say as formerly incarcerated people, we also have to hold people in prison accountable for their behavior, because that's the one thing that the quote-unquote other side, or sometimes people even on our side, will then use to say, you see, look, are these the type of people that you're representing? Are these mm-hmm. the type of is this the type of behavior that you're sanctioning? And the reality is that in many cases damages the little incremental steps that are being taken. So, you know, to understand that the best thing that they could do is understand they have a role, and to also be conscious of that role, particularly when it comes to behavior.
And we are out of time, but to contact and to get involved real quickly.
www.justleadershipusa.org or www.jlusa.org.
And I'm closing as we always close. Don't give in. Don't give out. Don't give up. Stand tall in spite of it all and stay on the count.
You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. Online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
That's a marvelous sight. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames.
Get it started. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world.
History lives on the Golden Age of Radio. every Sunday night, 7 to 9 p.m., here on listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI, New York.
And the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the fans.
For those who need to know. Coming in September exclusively over the transmission platform that is WBAI Pacifica Radio 99.5 FM, New York. A NOMO radio production in conjunction with the Artsy Fartsy Collective at the Brooklyn Common. Something you've never experienced before. Prepare yourself.
WBAI's got a lot of nerve. They challenge almost every social institution, but at least they leave religion alone.
Excuse me, but you're...